My name is Nora Lawrence. I'm in the Department of Painting and Sculpture here at MoMA, and I worked on the Monet Water Lilies show that's on view upstairs on the second floor, and I also co-wrote the catalog. So thank you so much for coming. I just want to take a minute to remind you to turn off all your cell phones if you have them on. This talk is not going to only be about Monet's history and the history of him making the water lilies, but also about, sorry, I'm going to adjust this for probably the next 5 minutes, also about the history of how they came to MoMA and their early history within our museum. This show is going to be on view upstairs until April 12th, so hopefully if you don't get a chance to see it today or if you haven't gotten a chance to see it in the past, you'll still have a little bit of time to get upstairs. Here are just two installation shots that I'll show you from our exhibition. This is our largest work called Water Lilies, which pretty much all of the works in the show, almost all the works in the show are called Water Lilies. This work is 42 feet wide and about 2 meters tall, and it's the largest Water Lilies composition that's together in one museum installation, or one museum collection in the United States. So it's sort of great that we have it and great that we have it on view. And here right across from it, as you'll see upstairs, is another Water Lilies composition. This one is a single panel, not a triptych like the other, and it's 19 feet across. So these are the two major works up there in the exhibition. I just wanted to give you a little bit of a background about Monet and where we're coming from in this exhibition. When you think Monet, you probably or almost definitely think Impressionism. And I want to tell you a little bit about how the works or his late water lilies that we have on display are different from his earlier Impressionist works. Works such as this one were made between 1914 and 1926, and I'll give you a little history of how they came to be. But here is a work that's sort of more typical of what we think of when we think of Monet and we think of Impressionism. This is called Impression Sunrise from 1872, and by a lot of accounts, it's actually even what the movement of Impressionism got named after. It's one of the earliest Impressionist, truly Impressionist works, and the reason we think of it in this way is because it was painted in front of its subject. It was something that Monet was painting outside. And I think you can tell by the fact that it is a sunrise right here that if you're painting something like this outside while just looking at your subject, you have to be painting it rather quickly to be able to capture this moment. And that's also something that's characteristic of Impressionist paintings, is this idea that they're painted quickly, they're an impression of reality rather than sort of a very detailed or very heavily worked at rendering of something. So you can see the individual brush strokes, and this is probably not new information to some of you. Also, the content of the work, we have some industrial elements back here, some cranes or some different things that sort of signify that we're working within an industrial city, and that's something also that was important to the Impressionists, was to show the reality of Paris that they were working within at the time. After his the period that he became best known for being this Impressionist period, in the 1880s and 90s, Monet started working in a slightly different style, and I think you're probably familiar with these works as well, these grain stack images that he was painting in the French countryside. These are from 1891. And one thing that these are often said to be different, one reason why these are often said to be different from Impressionist works is because they are done in this serial fashion. So it's not just this one fleeting moment or this one fleeting look at, say, this sunrise, but it is something that Monet is going back to. And even if these works are still done on the spot, as they generally speaking are, he's still working it outside and in front of his subject. It's a subject that he's returning to again and again over the course of this year and representing in these different ways. We can see that sometimes we see the grain stack in the snow, sometimes we see it sort of in the morning light. So all of these different visions of it together are coming together, you could say, as one larger work of art as the series. Monet was a very shrewd artist and was very good at manipulating his market and very good at creating a market for himself. And this is something that he really did with these grain stack images and other works that he was doing in series right at the turn of the 1880s to 1890s. You can think of the Rouen Cathedral paintings or the poplar paintings as different works that he was doing in series. And what he would do is he would organize these as singular exhibitions and show them all together in a room. So people would be able to see these different reflections of the same type of scene. And rather than thinking, oh, well, that's a Monet painting that someone else might have. Somebody else has a grain stack, so I'm not going to buy it. It actually created this fervor for owning one of the grain stacks, because you could be sort of part of this moment in his work and part of this great series by buying one of them or buying two of them and bringing them home. So he would sell them more or less individually, but would show them at the outset together in these collective groupings. In 1883, so actually before he painted these works in 1891, Monet began to rent a house in Giverny in about 45 minutes north of Paris in the French countryside. And he started to create not only a garden on the property, which is where we can see him in this view, but also a water garden on the property. And this is actually a photograph by Cartier-Bresson taken in the 1950s of Monet's water garden. And he rented this house in 1883, bought the house in 1890, and was continuously expanding his grounds and continuously trying to sort of expand his water garden as well. He went so far as to go through all of these different negotiations with the town of Giverny to expand his pond, make it bigger. He was damming up a local river in order to sort of make this larger expanse. So he was really clashing with the town as he tried to put this together. And you can see from the background here, he had installed two Japanese-style bridges, one at either end of the pond. And he also was importing all different types of flowers from all over the world. He was a great gardener, and he, I think, also had hired 6 full-time gardeners on the property at the time, so he could really make this sort of Arcadia that he really wanted and this utopian vision for his own life. He didn't really start painting this water garden until 1899, even though he had started developing it maybe 7 years earlier. And we think this is probably because it took this long for him to cultivate all of these different flowers and for him to really get it to the point where he wanted it to be before he started making images of it. These are works that he created of this water garden or of this pond between about 1903 and 1909. And he showed them all together in an exhibition where he had been showing the grain stacks as well at Durand Ruel Gallery in Paris, and did the same type of setup as earlier serial works. He was showing them all together in a room so you could see these different views of his water garden up to this point. These works are still more or less easel size works. When I say that, I mean they're about 1 meter by 1 meter, so they're not gigantic compositions. And he was working in the style. You can see that they're still somewhat clearly representational as well. With this one, for instance, you can see these trees that are being reflected upside down. You can see that we're sort of receding into further depth because these pond lilies in the front, or these water lilies in the front, are sort of larger than these smaller circular elements of them in the back. So we still are looking at this as somewhat of a more traditional picture than what we're going to get to later on. And sometimes you can even see a little bit of the bank maybe that he was looking towards as he made them. So he's making these works outside on site. But then right around 1915, he ends up building this very large studio on his property. And here's an image of it. And he did this because he really had a vision of these water lilies paintings going farther. He spoke as early as 1898 about, quote, that he wanted to make a project consisting of large panels covering the lower part of a wall that would be entirely occupied by a water horizon with plants spread across it. And then again in 1909, on the occasion of his Durand Ruel exhibition of those water lilies paintings that we were just looking at, he spoke again about wanting, quote, a circular room to decorate of modest, carefully calculated dimensions. All around, up to half a man's height, would have spread a painting of water and flowers, passing through every possible modulation. So in order to create this sort of surrounding atmospheric group of water lilies paintings, he felt that he had to create this new studio on his property that could accommodate, as we can see here, these very, very large-scale works that were very different than those earlier sort of smaller 1 meter by 1 meter compositions that he was making before. And it's interesting to look through his different writings and letters that he was writing about the studio at the time, because he just thought it was an absolute blight. He thought it was hideous. It has these concrete floors and this very modern design with these enormous skylights. And he just thought, I can't believe I'm doing this, but I have to at the same time. And so he knew that this is what he needed to do for his art, but he was also sort of ruining this one part of his beloved countryside home. So I think that's sort of an interesting point. And these are works, as you look at them, you can see these are not works that he could have brought outside and made on the spot right next to his pond, as he could have with these earlier works here. So the process of his work starts to change, and he starts to make these studies for these larger water lily panels. Here's one that was on view until February up in our show, and now we've replaced it with another work, but it was on loan from the Metropolitan Museum uptown. And these works are about 1 meter on their short side and 2 meters on their long side. So they're larger than these earlier water lilies paintings, and this is a different one of them that's still on view from a private collection upstairs. But they're still possible. He still was able to bring them outside and wheel them around. He had assistants. He had these little dollies, and he'd be able to wheel them around and look at them at the side of his pond and really create them by the side of his pond. So he would use these and then bring them inside as studies for these much larger water lilies panels that he would make in this gigantic studio that he had created for himself. One thing that, just to go back to this for 1 second, I just wanted you to look at the difference in the type of composition that we have between this first decade of the 1900s and then the second decade with these works that we're generally dating from 1914 to 1926, all of the works upstairs in our show. And you can see, as I was saying, we have this recession into depth and the different size of the water lilies here and then back here. And this is a lot more hazy in terms of this traditional composition. It almost looks like we're just looking straight down on these water lilies. There's often not the same recession into depth or the same idea of creating a traditional composition. And this is something that really changes in these years. He's starting to look at this project differently, and he's not really framing these as these individual paintings anymore. He's really thinking towards this larger project and how someone could just be absolutely encompassed by the sight of these water lilies. So it's almost like this bird's eye view onto it a lot of the time. Just also to talk about one reason why these are sort of, we haven't been considering them impressionist paintings, and I think that's sort of a little bit confusing, but one reason why these larger paintings are not thought of to be impressionist paintings is for this very reason, that he's not making them on the spot. He's using these studies. They're not these plein air sketches anymore. And we did some x-ray analysis. This is a detail from our largest 42-foot panel. And we did some x-ray analysis and found out that there are just as many as 15 layers of paint over each other on these compositions. And if you look upstairs, one of the curators in the 1950s actually referred to these as leathery works, which is a little bit of an insult probably, but for this idea that they have this really, really thick skin, and you can see just these ripples of paint if you actually look at the surface of them upstairs, even on a lot of the studies. And so what's interesting about them, so they're serial works, so they're not this one moment of time the way this Impression Sunrise would be, but they're also works that he was making over this long course of time. And that's why if you look upstairs and you think, oh, well, great job dating them 1914 to 1926, can't you be a little bit more precise? The thing is that we can't, because as we've looked at ours, we realize there are certain parts where a flower may have been painted over and it's just a piece of an added element of water now, or these different compositional elements are just gone that used to be present within the paintings. And we really believe that these were works that he was making over that whole course of time, that weren't things that he did in one particular year or a different particular year. It's also difficult if you look back at images, there are lots of images of Monet in his studio from around 1917, but some of those works we're not able to really find anymore. And we know that Monet was destroying some of these large works that he was making, destroying a lot of these studies that he was making. And so we don't know, well, is this one not something we can find anymore because it's been destroyed or because it's been painted so completely differently since this photograph was taken? Here's just another detail. Another difference between these late water lilies paintings and essentially everything else that Monet had made during the course of his career is that he wasn't selling them individually. And he was never selling the smaller 1 meter by 2 meter studies. He made about 250 of those studies, and he made about 40 to 50, we're not sure exactly how many, of these larger panels that are all between 14 feet and about 20 feet. He was looking to them, as I already sort of indicated in those quotes, he was looking to them to be part of something larger. He wasn't looking to sell them off piece by piece or looking to sell individual panels separately out to different collectors, which is something different even from his later serial work, as I had said. What he wanted to do was create this encompassing exhibition or installation that he finally got the opportunity to do at the Orangerie Museum. And here's one view of the museum in 1930. And this is an installation that was finally put together in 1927, so actually the year after Monet's death. Monet was good friends with Georges Clemenceau, who had been the prime minister of France in the first decade of the 20th century. And in talks with him, Clemenceau was a big supporter of Monet, and Monet agreed to give what started out as two of these panels to the French state in 1918 in honor of their victory in World War I. This gift then turned out to be 22 panels as they talked more and more about it. But as I said, Monet was very shrewd, and he said, "I will give you these panels only if I can completely control where and how they're installed." And we'll talk about a few of the reasons for this, but Monet was very, very adamant that they be installed in the order that he gave them, and also that they be permanently attached to the walls of the Orangerie. So there are actually two of these sort of circular rooms or oval rooms at the Orangerie that are next to each other that have these sort of encompassing Monet installations. And he asked for each of these panels to be glued to the wall so that they could never be removed. He wasn't interested in doing this sort of as a temporary installation, but more as something that absolutely had to be part of the Orangerie. And that's something that, if you think about the history of French modern art at this time, I think speaks to Monet's sort of diminishing lack of popularity, or this idea that Monet is no longer sort of a piece of the French avant-garde at this point. He's best known for his Impressionist period and those works just afterwards, but in the early 1900s, if you think about what else is going on in France, we have Picasso's Demoiselles d'Avignon here from 1907, and then we have Majoli by Picasso from, I think, 1911. So these are works that are being produced by Picasso in France even before Monet starts on this 1914 to 1926 project of the water lilies. And so he's really not doing what are sort of the most avant-garde works in this period, at least as it was being perceived to France contemporarily. And he was in his 70s and 80s when he was making the water lilies, and as I said, it was sort of his last major project. And then just to look at a few other things that are happening during the course of him making them, this is a Mondrian work from, I think, 1922. Mondrian is inventing this language of complete abstract spiritual geometry. And then also, neither of these are happening in France, but Malevich in Russia is creating this suprematist language. This is a painting from 1915. So just think about how different from these Monet's works are, and how much he really is isolating himself in Giverny and doing something very different, much more in line with what he'd done earlier, but not in line with sort of these newest trends within the world of contemporary art. And it turns out that Monet was absolutely on point and was absolutely right to be so protective of his works. This is an image of the Orangerie in 1942 after a bombing. And you can see that the skylight is just absolutely, it's been sort of crashed through, but then there are also these watermarks on the ceiling. Here's a lamp that's come down to the floor. You can see how it looks just like this. There's a hole in the wall here. And in the years before the wall, this is the war, and this is obviously sort of a very explicit image of something. But even before the war, there were different installations at the Orangerie where the curators would just hang works right over Monet's paintings. So there was a tapestries installation, for instance, where they just hung them directly over these Monet paintings that they couldn't get off the walls. So you could see how this artist, towards the end of his life, was really thinking ahead and thinking about how to preserve his legacy, and then it ends up being really true that he needed to be so protective. And it's interesting to think back because Monet is so well revered now, but from the 1920s or mid-1920s until about 1950, there were very few Monet shows, particularly shows of his late work, and he wasn't appreciated in nearly the same way that we appreciate him today. This room, so it's gone through several courses of renovation since this period, but even in the late 1940s, the American artist Jack Youngerman, who we spoke to as we were putting together this show, said that he remembers going to the Orangerie because he had this interest in Monet, and seeing that all the guards sitting in the room with him were just asleep, that he had it all to himself, that no one was there except for him, and that there really wasn't this great interest in his work at this time. This changes right around 1950 for reasons that I'll explain to you. This is the first work that by Monet that entered the Museum of Modern Art collection in 1951. It's a Poplar's composition from 1888. And it entered as a gift. It wasn't something that we really pursued, but I just wanted to give you sort of a background about when we started collecting Monet, which was a lot later than when we started collecting, for instance, Cézanne or Seurat. But this is the first work in our collection, and then it was followed 4 years later by this Water Lilies composition, which we acquired in 1955. This is in black and white for reasons that I'll explain later. It's not actually a black and white composition. But this work came to us, basically it started because a trustee of the museum, Walter Chrysler Jr., who was an art collector, acquired one of these panels that were left over in Monet's studio. So obviously none of these are from the Orangerie where they were attached to the walls, and they weren't being exhibited in any other way because Monet only wanted them as this full installation at the Orangerie. So these were actually works that were left over in his studio that right around 1950 his son Michel began to sell. So Walter Chrysler had gotten one in 1950 and had told the founding director of MoMA, whose name is Alfred Barr, about it. And it is in this moment of this new interest in Monet's late work. In 1949, there was an exhibition that included several of these large water lilies paintings, I think in Zurich, and then in 1952, another exhibition that included them in Basel. And so MoMA and different other collections around the world were really going on a search for what was left of this late production of Monet's. So basically, we got word that there were still works in his studio. And Alfred Barr sent James Thrall Sobey, who was the chairman of the Museum Collection Committee, and also Dorothy Miller, who was the curator of the museum collection, to France to go and look at these water lilies paintings. And this is the one that they chose from about 12 of them and brought back to New York for the MoMA collection. Here is the way that it was first displayed in 1955, and this is in the winter of 55-56. This is part of a new acquisitions exhibition of 50 or 60 works that all went on view together. And this work was really thought of as the big highlight of this new acquisition show. You can see, I love this sort of very, very dramatic presentation on this black wall with this sort of very dramatic lighting and these curtains that we'd never really see again today in our galleries, at least. And it was noticed by the press, and here's a few things that they said. The New York Times called the painting, quote, the biggest surprise and the greatest triumph for the museum. and said that it shimmers like an impressionist view of paradise, so this hugely complimentary review. And then a reviewer for The Nation magazine selected this composition as, quote, the major addition to the collection, and said, paradoxically, this is at once the most old-fashioned, the least fashionable, and the most daring of the acquisitions. For it has been a long time since late Impressionism, with its soft interweavings of color and blurred fluid forms, has stirred any enthusiasm among collectors and museums. So it's something that really is being noticed as something very new. And one other thing that I just think is funny about the course of this acquisition is there were very much practical concerns being thought about, as well as sort of this more idealistic concern of trying to get this great Monet painting. Barr was writing telegrams to Miller and Sobey while they were in Paris and visiting the studio and saying things like, quote, I don't want to limit whatever you and Dorothy may decide, he writes to Sobey. You know our space problem in this Midtown Museum as well as I do. Anything over 20 feet would be impractical in our current collection and perhaps out of scale in relation to other things. But I certainly agree with you that a considerable size may be highly desirable, though possibly 8 or 10 feet will do. And we end up getting one at 19 feet, so almost twice what Alfred Barr was looking for. But it's just, I think that's such a funny moment in all of this, because we're still thinking about the size of the building, and we're still always wondering what else we might need to do to accommodate new art. So I sort of like this as this precedent for everyone here. Up until the point when we acquired this 19-foot Monet, the only works larger than it, there were only two in the collection at the time when we acquired it. This actually is a work that was not officially in the collection. This is obviously Guernica by Picasso from 1937. It was on long-term loan here from 1941. It was lent to us by Picasso. And so this was a painting that was larger than the Monet water lilies at 25 feet wide rather than 19. But it's a very different type of composition. It's large because it has something important to say, unlike Monet's, which is large because it's trying to be something encompassing and decorative in a very different way. This is a work that's being done because of the Spanish Civil War, and it's being done almost as a history painting. It's representative of a subject, which I think is something that, in a way, Monet's work is too, but it's much, much softer, and the subject is just a landscape. It's not something as important or as needing of the space as something like Guernica would be. The only other work that was in our permanent collection that was larger than this Monet water lily that I just showed you is Dive Bomber and Tank by Orozco, the Mexican painter. That's upstairs on view and part of this Mexican muralism tradition that also has these political implications and also is part of a representative tradition of art. And so acquiring this Monet is something really different. It's a really different type of large work. And the reason why a lot of people have talked about there being the space, the mental space for this type of large-scale, near-abstract work in the 1950s and not before is because of the new interest in abstract expressionism that was occurring both in New York and all over the world from there. This is Jackson Pollock's number 31, 1950, that was on display in 1950 in a gallery in New York City. And also, these are both works in our collection, Barnett Newman's Vir Heroicus Sublimus from 1950 to 1951. Both of these works are just about the same size as that Monet water lilies painting that I just showed you, and both of them have this same type of abstract, very personal content rather than something historical or sort of more representational than as the Guernica was or as the Orozco painting was. So it's almost like the presence of these works, these large-scale abstract works and the interest in them in New York galleries is clearing this space for Monet as their precedent in a way that he had never really been accepted before. It had always been thought, oh, well, these works are messy, these large water lilies are not really the essence of what Monet should be doing, and so they were rejected. But then when these works come along, they're sort of brought back in, and they have something historical to say. They're a precedent for something else that becomes very important within the world of modern and contemporary art. Give me one second. If you've been up to, let me just say also, these paintings, as I said, were in our collection, but we didn't acquire them to the late 1960s. So Monet was actually coming way before we actually bought these two works at this large scale. If you've been up to the first galleries of our permanent collection on the fifth floor, you'll notice that the collection starts just after Impressionism. Generally, we think of our collection as starting right around 1880, and so we skip Monet's traditional Impressionist style and move on to what we consider post-Impressionist in Cézanne, and in Seurat, for instance. And these become this beginning point for a very specific type of modern art and modern art history. If you look at this Cézanne painting next to, again, Majoli from 1911, you can see, I think, in the type of brushstroke what Picasso is picking up. Picasso here is picking up from Cézanne. We have this constructive stroke, these little bits of color that are really looking at, they show the way in which Cézanne was looking at nature as something geometric. He spoke about trying to find these geometric essences within nature, and that's something that I think you can think about as you look at his very sort of more structural landscape compositions, that you can see these sort of geometric elements within it. And this structural idea is something that completely undergirds the Cubist style and a lot of these other early modern or early 19th century styles of modern art that our museum really prized in the first half of the 20th century. And here again is Seurat, and I just want to show you again the differences between Impressionism and Seurat come in this very stillness of the figures. You can see there's nothing, even as this is Sunday afternoon on Le Grand Jatte, which is from 1886, and even as this is just an image of everyday life in Paris, it's also something that's absolutely planned out and absolutely perfectly composed. There's no aspect of any paint that goes from one element into another. There's no bleeding at all with the Seurat work, and these different figures almost look like they were dropped in to this landscape rather than sort of being this more organic whole with it. So it really is a different type of painting than what we were looking at with Monet's Impression Sunrise. Here's another work that, again, this is a black and white reproduction of it. That's a work that we acquired in, it's about 2 meters by 2 meters. It's another one of these studies for Monet's water lilies painting, so about 6 feet by 6 feet, I should say. And we acquired this in 1956 after getting that large water lilies in 1955. Alfred Barr went back to Paris in the summer of 56 and acquired this work for the museum. And then this work, along with two others, but this one is now at the Met Museum, as I had said, and he acquired it on behalf of one of MoMA's trustees at that time. He brought it over from Paris, and she ended up buying it from the gallery. And what's sort of funny about this is that this is a work that we always assumed was coming to the MoMA. And we didn't really realize this until we started doing some archival research and looked back, but Louise Reinhardt Smith, who gave this to the Met, was a patron of both of these collections. But if you think about Alfred Barr finding it and buying it for her, obviously it was with this idea that it would come back to us eventually, and it ended up going uptown. So we were sort of happy to have it on view for a little while in our galleries here. But so these are two works that he acquired in 56. And then also in 1956, we got this Japanese footbridge painting from Nodler Gallery, which was having a late Monet show in New York. So again, this sort of verve for late Monet paintings. And this painting is often talked about for its very different color scheme. And it's often talked about as something that was the result of Monet's series of operations on his eyes for cataract treatments. And we're not quite sure that's possible. It was right around the same time when he would end up wearing different color glasses to sort of to correct his vision and make his vision sort of more even. But also this sort of excessive brushiness is either part of what Monet was looking for at this time or could be part of his failing vision. We're not quite sure. We haven't really made a real definite decision on that yet. So those were just some paintings that we acquired in 56. In 1958, there was a fire in the museum on the second floor. And it was a floor that was being closed at this time because we were installing air conditioning, which now is so funny when you think about a contemporary museum and how important air conditioning is to us upstairs in our galleries. Here it comes for the first time. And so during this installation of the air conditioning on this floor, almost all of the works in our collection that had been on the second floor were moved to the third floor or the first floor in preparation for this. Downstairs on the first floor was an exhibition that actually included the Seurat painting. And it was only this is at the Art Institute of Chicago, and within the deed by which they acquired this painting, they were only allowed to lend it out once. And so it comes to the MoMA for this one time that it's being lent out to another installation, and there's actually this fire in the building, and it has to be carried out with all of these other works. But so just to say that there was so much to be taken out of the building on the occasion of this fire from the first and third floors, but then there were also a few works that ended up staying on the second floor or right near the second floor because they were too large to be transported elsewhere, one of them being the large 1955 water lilies that I just showed you, and now you can understand why I showed it to you in black and white, which was kept in a plywood box against the windows of the second floor galleries and actually ended up being destroyed as the firefighters came in through the windows into the building to put out the fire. So we lost that painting. We also lost this painting, which actually, wait, I have a slide right here. So just showing you this, and we lost this painting entirely. The New York Times ended up reporting that it looked like a toasted marshmallow after the fire, and that the oil paint on it was just sort of this swirl of paint, and that didn't really represent anything anymore. This painting, this Monet painting, was actually hanging in the stairwell between the second and third floor next to this Jackson Pollock work, which is a smaller Jackson Pollock than the one we saw before, but is something that is from 1948. And I just think it's interesting they were hanging together because of this interest in comparing Monet's work with this abstract expressionist work. But basically, this was hanging closer to the third floor. This was hanging closer to the second. And we've restored this work, and it's on view upstairs. You can see it today if you'd like. But this one was considered a total loss after much thought and much many attempts for its conservation. What's interesting about it is we ended up basically taking the pieces of it and giving the pieces to the NYU Conservation Institute. And so they still have these pieces of this Monet painting that they can look at and refer to when they're trying to study the effects of fire on paintings and what can be done. What's also interesting, so just here's another view of what we lost. What's also interesting is that in the wake of this fire, we got so many letters, and we did a lot of archival research as we worked towards putting the show up. We got so many letters from people, just from the general public, from different artists, from everybody, not only saying how sad they were about the painting, but often saying how, or the loss of the paintings, but also saying how they just really wanted one little piece of it. I'll give you the postage if you just send me a 2x3 square of the Monet painting. I would just like to keep it forever. And one person who wrote a letter, actually not asking for the remains, but just sort of telling us of his sympathy for the loss of these paintings, was Dan Flavin, who in the 1960s, this is a work from 1963, became this minimalist artist working with fluorescent lights. And so a very, very different style from Monet. And it's interesting for us to read about his interest in Monet at this time. And he wrote to us, quote, "I will so miss the large picture, but any portion of it which can be saved will be enough for me. My heart still aches over the loss." So I think we don't really think of Dan Flavin as somebody who expresses himself in that way. So it was so interesting for us to find this letter up in the files, and we actually ended up sending it to the Flavin studio. And so what ended up happening as a result of this is that, as I said, there were still these paintings in Giverny. There were about 12 or 14 of them left in the studio that Monet had never displayed anywhere. And Barr sent our curators back to Giverny to pick out a different work with the insurance money. And so we ended up with this large triptych, 42 feet long, so sort of replacing what had been lost and then you know, just making it even more spectacular, from 19 feet to 42 feet. And this is a view of this 42-foot panel in the first installation that it had in 1959 here at the museum. And I sort of love this woman sitting before it, and you can see this idea of sort of absolutely being enchanted by a painting and being overwhelmed by a painting, sort of being within it as this atmospheric experience, not unlike at all what Barnett Newman wanted people to do before his very abstract compositions just sort of get lost in them. So we ended up purchasing this work as well as this work within those next 2 years. And what had happened was the prices had gone up enormously, because the first time around in 1959, we'd bought two works actually in 55 and 56. We bought those two works from Michel Monet, from the artist's son. And in these 3 years, Katya Granoff, who was an art dealer in Paris, had actually bought them from Michel Monet. And so when we bought that first 19-foot painting, we bought it for $11,500. And when we ended up buying this work and this work, just 3 or 4 years later, this one was $150,000, and this one was $85,000. So just to show you how much all of this interest can really change the prices very, very quickly. One thing that I still think is interesting is we've tried to sort of mimic this encompassing installation that Monet wanted for the Orangerie by tilting these two sides of the triptych towards the audience a little bit, so you can sort of get that sense of being surrounded by something. But it is this museological question. We're not the only ones by any means. There are other compositions like this at, again, in Zurich, at the National Gallery in London, at a few other institutions in the United States. But it's an interesting question. What does it mean to show works that the artist himself wouldn't have put on view? He would never meant for these works that he ended up leaving in his studio to ever see the public eye. And so it's an interesting thing. I think it makes a lot of sense to us, because obviously these are great paintings and they are this moment of history and this sort of great project that Monet was working on. It's also a way of showing to New York audiences something that they would have to go to Paris or to Giverny to see, to Paris to see otherwise at the Orangerie. But it is this interesting question of how much does the artist intention matter, how much should it matter when we make decisions about what to put on display. And just to show you a little bit of the continuing interest in Monet beyond those abstract expressionists who often did express their interest in Monet, as I said, Jack Youngerman, also Ellsworth Kelly was taking trips to Giverny. Andy Warhol, with his flowers, may have been thinking about Monet when in 1964 he did this serial presentation of several of his flowers, and we have this view and this view, at the Sonnabend Gallery in Paris, right essentially across the way from the Tuileries Garden where the Orangerie is and from Monet's flowers. So maybe he was looking at them vis-a-vis each other. And he has this funny quote about Monet and abstract expressionism. And he says about MoMA, he says, "The galleries had been full of abstract expressionists and impressionists. And then it was as if somebody had said, 'Why, look at Monet, that sweet old man. He was doing all these wild things before you were even born.'" So he's really sort of thinking about Monet and thinking about how different and new his late work was. And then we also have, this is a work in our collection, F111 by James Rosenquist from 1965. And he displayed this on the four walls in its first installation. This is a very large scale piece, as you can see in these different component parts. He displayed it on all four walls of the Castelli Gallery in New York on its first installation in 1965, and said that he was thinking about the way that Monet was surrounded by his own paintings, and that he wanted to be surrounded by color, just as Monet had surrounded himself with color when he made his water lilies paintings. So this is something that is resonating in the 60s as well as with 50s artists. And then just to show you, before we had it on display in our new building, a lot of people remember this installation of these water lilies paintings looking over our garden here in the old building of MoMA. And just to show you a few images of the Orangerie, lest you think that it's still in that horrible state that I last showed you it in, But just to say, these are here. They were, the orangery was renovated again, I think in 2005 or 2006, and they're in their full glory there. I hope you get upstairs to see our show and see the New York version of Monet's Water Lilies. And thank you for coming, and I'll take any questions you might have. Yeah. It wasn't necessarily that they were unfinished. Oh, was the idea that the paintings were unfinished and this is why they were still in his studio. It's interesting because I think he was just thinking about this project differently from how he had thought about anything in the past. It wasn't, the goal wasn't each individual painting, and it wasn't selling each individual painting anymore. It was coming up with the best group that he possibly could. So as he's working through and figuring out which works to donate to the orangery, some works would come into the installation, some works would go out, but he ended up with the group that he wanted, and I think the other works that were left over weren't necessarily unfinished, but were sort of outliers from that final group that he put together. There was also a painting, he did sort of a, I think he felt that he had made a mistake in 1919. He did sell one of these panels. But then the collector who he sold it to tried to put it on view, and he got in touch with everybody and made that installation get canceled. So he wasn't letting anyone else show them individually either, but just wanted them to be in the orangery. Yeah?
When you say individually, you mean because it was a triptych, you didn't want one show. But what makes you think he didn't want them shown?
He wouldn't let them be shown. He only wanted them for the orangery. He wasn't selling them the way that he'd sold all of his earlier works. He wasn't sort of letting them out of his own possession. So he never displayed any of these smaller, the two-meter studies. He never put them on view at all, though he had ample opportunity, and his collectors and dealers were sort of saying, hey, where's your next show? He wouldn't do it. He was sort of looking for this sort of larger project that would be the culmination of his life, really. Yeah.
It's not called Impressionism. What is the style that's this repeated, not...
Yeah, so what is the style, if it's not called Impressionism, of these later works?
Yeah.
Sometimes you might call it... I don't think that there's one word, and so I'd be sort of... I'd be leading you astray if I told you that there was, but I think sometimes it's considered a type of post-impressionism, that it's working from these impressionist principles, just as Seurat is working from this idea of giving you an everyday view of Paris, but then turning it into something very different. Yeah.
Well, from 1917 on, they were getting more abstract as the cataracts got worse.
That's, yeah.
I think it's reflected. If you look at the Mammoth paintings, you see the reflection of the sky, which you did in the earlier, and what we have in the meadow, it's just absolutely layered.
Yeah, there's so many layers, and maybe just the comment was that maybe it's a result of these cataracts that he has, and that's absolutely, I mean, they're much looser paintings. One thing we also have noticed since this has been on display is it almost seems, if you look towards the bottom of the composition, it's sort of like he's really reaching down. You can see these swipes that he's taking as he's working on this large scale that seem like they're really reflective of the way in which he was making them rather than necessarily what he intended them to look like.
Why?
Sorry?
Because the paintbrush
would... Right, it's just sort of really reaching and getting down there. Anything else? Okay, thank you so much.